Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
I'm Erin Fairbanks, host of The Farm Report. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Greetings and welcome to Animal Instinct here on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Celia Kutcher, also known as the Food Healer, and today we're talking about wolves with Maggie Howell, Executive Director of the Wolf Conservation Center in South Salem, New York. Maggie Howell has been Executive Director since 2005, starting as the Wolf Conservation Center's Managing Director and taking the helm as Executive Director in 2013. She continues to lead the WCC's education and advocacy initiatives, as well as being their main voice. In 2014, Maggie became the coordinator for the Northeast Wolf Coalition. Maggie's calling in from Westchester County, New York. Hey, Maggie, are you there?
I am. Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for talking with us today. I'm really excited to learn all about wolves and the Wolf Conservation Center. So, you ready to get started?
Sure.
All right. Let's start with basic question. How many species are there of wolves?
Well, here in North America, it's actually up in the air as much as, I guess. But right now, there's two different species of wolf. There's the gray wolf, which is probably the wolf that you would imagine if you envision what a wolf looks like and what a wolf is.
Mm-hmm.
And gray wolves can be found really all over the globe in the northern hemisphere. And then there's the very rare red wolf, which is kind of like our American wolf, because this is the wolf that really the only place that exists today is right here in our country.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and they're critically endangered. They're mostly in North Carolina in the wild. There's about two right off the coast of Florida. But otherwise, that's the only place they live, which makes them pretty special.
Wow. Wow, I'm shocked that it's such a small area for that. Wow.
Yeah, well, they had a larger area. Unfortunately, being what we are as a species,
yeah.
We pretty much took away a lot of their habitat and killed most of the large predators here in our country.
Mm.
So the red wolf actually went extinct in the wild. And it wasn't until over 20 years ago that we reintroduced them into a portion of their ancestral home. So the only place they were reintroduced was the coast of North Carolina.
Wow. And so are there wolves on all the continents?
No. So right now, there's really below south of the border, or south of the equator, you're not going to have wolves, although some people do debate whether the Ethiopian wolf is a wolf or a different creature altogether. But otherwise, they're basically found, you know, in the northern hemisphere, but they're incredibly adaptable, and at one time they probably did live in most of the available space in the northern hemisphere.
And then where do wolves live? Like, what do they make as their homes?
Well, again, they're so adaptable. They can live in really all sorts of places. You know, we have wolves in the Arctic tundra with the Arctic gray wolf.
Mm-hmm.
We have Mexican gray wolves living as far south as central Mexico at one time. So they're in the forest, they're in the high desert, they can really live in the mountains. So really, all they need in order to survive is a prey base and a suitable habitat. So, but in that way, they're really remarkable in that they're very resilient, which is a good thing.
Yeah. And so what do wolves eat?
Well, wolves are carnivores.
Okay.
So they eat meat and a lot of it. The menu will vary depending on where they're living.
Mm-hmm.
For example, wolves in the Southwest, the critically endangered Mexican gray wolf, they're going to be eating elk. They're going to be they could hunt javelina even, small mm-hmm. rodents, birds, deer. Up in the Arctic, you're going to have a different menu. It's going to be the caribou, the musk ox. They can eat lemmings, Arctic hare. So really, they're going to be looking for what's available in their area, but they prefer to hunt the large game. And so that would include the elk or the muskox or the caribou. And they hunt these animals because they can provide a lot of meat for the entire wolf family. So it really is helpful and a lot easier if they can hunt one animal and provide meals for everyone than, you know, they only have to hunt once. But it's hard to hunt those large animals. They're bigger and they're faster and they're stronger. So it's not easy being a wolf.
And do they scavenge at all?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Most wild animals will. I certainly would.
I would too.
Pass up a free meal if I had to. So, yeah, wolves will definitely scavenge. And you know, a lot of people think scavenger is like a bad word, where it really isn't. You have to remember, when you're hunting these animals, you know, food fights back.
Yeah.
And one kick from one of these large ungulates, an animal like a deer or a bison or elk, could really end a wolf's career or life.
Yeah.
So if there's a free meal, by all means, they're going to try to get it.
And so when they hunt, do they hunt by themselves or do they go out in packs?
Normally, they're going to be hunting together in the family groups or packs. And that's because it's a lot easier, of course, if you're hunting these large animals, if you have some teamwork, some backup. And you know, I'm sure all packs or families have their own strategies.
Yeah.
But they're not ambush hunters. The way, you know, they're not going to, well, they don't climb trees, but they're not going to be up in a tree and just kind of ambush their prey. Really, they're going to be looking for the most vulnerable animal out there to hunt.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's a herd of deer, for example, they're going to be assessing the situation and trying to figure out which one will take the least amount of energy to catch. And again, that's because hunting is difficult.
Yeah.
And they're going to try to hunt every day. Most of the time, they're not going to succeed. So they really need to choose carefully. Also, again, because hunting is dangerous.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't mean they don't hunt on their own.
Mm-hmm.
Wolves can hunt on their own, and sometimes there have even been cases where wolves have been documented hunting the large prey on their own and doing it successfully, but that's not very common. Normally, when they're hunting by themselves, they're going to be hunting the smaller animals like beaver or rabbit and bird, stuff like that.
And what do wolves do? Like, what's their role on the planet?
Wolves. Well, wolves are a keystone species, which I just love that term. In fact, because I just think of the keystone of an arch and kind of holding everything in balance, and that's really what a keystone species is. And basically, if you have a keystone species within an ecosystem, so within nature, it's usually a really good indicator that that system is going to be relatively balanced, it's going to be healthy, and it's going to support biodiversity, which is, of course, good for the health of nature.
Yeah.
So wolves, they demonstrate this in the fact that they're going to be controlling the population of those large grazing animals. So, again, the deer, the elk, the bison.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing so, they're actually going to help safeguard the habitat because the animals they eat, these are the herbivores, the vegetarians. And so by controlling those numbers, it will allow enough plants and trees to grow, which will provide habitat and food for lots of other critters. So really what the wolf has kind of demonstrated is that it's that like important piece of Mother Nature's puzzle that holds everything in balance. And you know, everything in nature has an important job to do.
Yeah.
It just happens to be wolf being kind of the top of the pyramid has that trickle-down effect on many other levels. Now, that isn't to say that the wolf is the only, you know, if you stick a wolf into some ecosystem that, ta-da, it's going to be perfect.
Yeah, yeah.
But it is definitely an important component of the systems where it belongs.
Wow. That's really cool. And then what's their social structure like? Like, who's in charge? Is it the girls or the boys?
Oh, the girls.
Yay.
No, it depends on the family. Just like our families, it's going to, you know, it'll be different. But I've always been partial to the female wolves, personally. So, but no, they, you know, it really depends. Sometimes you have the stronger personalities or even the stronger leadership qualities in the female, and sometimes it's in the male.
Wow.
So a lot of people, you know, the term alpha wolf is kind of that, you know, I'm the boss, I'm the alpha here. And it's interesting because that terminology is kind of fading away because really people aren't looking at packs so much as the alpha and the beta and the omega, mm-hmm. but rather just a family unit with mom and dad, they're in charge, and then they have their pups of different years, and they can either stay or go eventually. But what's interesting is we actually made these T-shirts recently, just kind of as a joke way to fundraise that just says Alpha Wolf. And we made them for men and in women's cut T-shirts. Uh-huh. And when we put it up on our Facebook page to advertise that we had these new fundraising T-shirts, everyone was challenging us, saying that the alpha couldn't be a female. And as a woman, I was upset about this.
Wait a minute.
And we had to make a big point to demonstrate that really the alpha and male and female, these are just parents.
Yeah.
And even if they aren't the parents, you certainly can have an alpha female.
Well,
so I hope our supporters learned from that day. But there's also another wolf who became kind of a media sensation. She lived in Yellowstone, and her name was, the name we gave her, or people gave her, was Gray Wolf 06.
Mm-hmm.
And she was born in 2006, and she was relatively visible to all the people that went to the park to go wildlife watching, so she became very popular. And this wolf, I would have to say, she wore the pants in the pack. If there was a woman in charge, it was this wolf. and sometimes even, you know, and I saw her personally twice in Yellowstone, but only through film have I actually seen some of the things that she did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hunting on her own and taking down the large prey on her own, and really just all business. And there's actually a film that came out by filmmaker Bob Landis, and it was on, I think, National Geographic's one that packaged it. And it's called She-Wolf.
Mm-hmm.
And you really see, first of all, how difficult it is being a wild anything, but also just, wow, this woman, this female wolf, she really was, I don't know, a powerful presence, to say the least. Sadly, she became even more of a media sensation when she, in 2012, in December, she went beyond the safety of Yellowstone's reach, so beyond the boundary of the park, and she was killed in Wyoming.
Oh, no.
And it was actually the first year at that point, the inaugural Wyoming wolf hunt. So it was the first year in quite some time, and it was... people all around the globe were just really touched by this news. And it's interesting, just like many celebrities, she became, I think, even more of a powerful presence in her death than she was when she was alive, because she actually had a name of a sort.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, God, whoever shot her must be like, whoa, you know.
Yeah.
Oof. Wow. It's I know so little about wolves, and I've researched them, and it's they're pretty tough to find out about, and they're kind of tough to find consistent information on as well. So like, I saw a lot of stuff about alpha and omegas, and it was like, no, it's always the female, she's always the alpha, and then there was some like, no, it's always the male. So thank you for clarifying that, because it's like, I don't know, you know.
It probably depends on the author.
Yeah, no kidding, right? No joke. All right, well, Maggie, we're going to take a quick break for station identification, but we'll be back in a minute, and we'll continue the conversation all about wolves.
You are listening to Different Kind of Animal by Eric Maltz.
Since 2001, Heritage Foods USA has sold pasture-raised, antibiotic-free heritage meats to restaurants and homes around the country. Our farmers raise their animals with care using traditional methods, guaranteed to produce the very best tasting meat. Our pork breeds include Berkshire, Redwattle, Duroc, Gloucester Old Spot, Large Black, and Tamworth, and our beef comes from Piedmontese, Angus, Akiyushi, Belgian Blue, Highland, Simmental, and Belted Galloway cattle. We also carry a rotation of 24 rare breeds of heritage chicken, seasonal specialties like lamb, goat, geese, and of course, heritage turkeys. Visit us online at www.heritagefoodsusa.com or give us a call at 718-389-0985 to place your order today.
Hello, this is Mark Ladner from Del Posto, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
And we are back. We are talking to Maggie Howell, Executive Director of the Wolf Conservation Center, all about wolves. This is fascinating. I love this. So, Maggie, here's a dumb question for the moment. Why do wolves howl, and how far can it be heard?
Well, wolves have many vocalizations, but the howl is by far the most famous or well-known. And I think, you know, sometimes wolves are going to be howling just to gather members of the family together. It's really to communicate long distance. Sometimes it's to warn one another of danger with something called the bark howl, which sounds definitely more urgent than some of the other howls. I personally think, and I have no scientific data to prove this, but sometimes I think they just like to sing. And you know, they can hear one another from really far distances, especially in open terrain. I've read some studies say as far as 10 miles away.
Wow.
In open terrain. So, I wish we could hear the howls here in the Northeast, but right now they're not here, but we'll have to cross our paws.
Yeah, definitely. And, there's nothing like a wolf howl if you hear that when you're camping and you're like, oh my God, where is that thing? You know, it's like you have no idea if it's 100 feet away from you or if it's 3 miles away.
And you know, we're at our at the Wolf Conservation Center, we currently have 20 wolves, and it doesn't get old. You know, when you hear the howls kind of roll down the hill of all these different voices and the harmonies, it's a wild experience. And I get goosebumps, and I should be numb to it, but I don't think I ever will become numb.
Well, I definitely want to talk about the WCC and some of the events you guys do, because I think it's amazing, but we're going to save that for a little bit, and I'm going to grill you on some more questions about wolves.
Cool.
All right, so here's a big one that I've gotten a lot of different answers for, and I want to hear what your thought is. What is their genetic relationship to dogs?
Oh, that is a complicated one. Well, you know, most agree that wolves or dogs did descend from wolves.
Mm-hmm.
What people continue to argue about or debate is when and where and how.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, there have been actually just several studies pretty recently that they pinpointed between 16,000 and 36,000 years ago is
wow.
probably when it started. But I think they're thinking more in the 30 range at this point. And whether it was in Asia or in Europe. What's really interesting is that because of DNA, just technology in terms of testing DNA and mitochondrial DNA. We have scientists actually looking at fossils and pulling DNA out of these fossils
wow.
to be able to track exactly what the canids' genetic makeup was at that, you know, thousands of years ago. So I'm just sitting back and watching the debate. I'm not doing the research firsthand by any means. But what I find just absolutely mind-blowing, and I have a very hard time wrapping my brain around this, is that all the breeds that we have today, you know, whether it's a Great Dane or a bulldog or a dachshund, that they all originated with the wolf. So just all the creative breeding that
yep.
would need to take place to kind of create all these different features and sizes and behaviors and personalities. So it blows me away. I have a hard time even thinking about it because I just I just can't believe that my dog's, you know, great, 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 yeah. whatever, was a wolf. I have a dachshund, so it's really hard to imagine.
Yeah, totally. It's really funny because I took a course a number of years ago that was based on, it was an animal behavior course, and it was based out of research from Oxford University. And there's some guy there that's written a paper that's, needless to say, incredibly controversial, where he's discovered, or his belief is that dogs actually evolved from a ancient type of tree squirrel. And I've been trying to find this paper again. Like, I can't even tell you how long I've been looking for this thing. I can't find it anywhere, which makes me wonder about it a little bit, you know. But it's interesting to see the different angles of where people are coming in, because when it's dogs, you know, and I'm with you with the wolf thing, like, they evolved from dogs, but, you know, we've got pugs and we've got Great Danes and German Shepherds, and it's like, how did this happen, really, you know? But
yeah,
they also had a long time.
I know. First of all, if anyone listening knows of that paper,
yeah, totally.
See it too. But no, it's amazing. And you know, when you think about it, I mean, we have dogs of all shapes and sizes, and because of, and a dog breeder would be a much better person to talk to, but because of just the kind of way we tweak these different traits and really, you know, push to have these certain expressions of the genes.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, you know, dogs can excel at certain things when it comes to wolves. You know, there are dogs that are faster than wolves.
Hmm.
There are dogs that are that have a better sense of smell than wolves, like bloodhounds.
Yeah.
And that's because we really took the wolf, which is just basically, you know, Mother Nature's mound of clay, and kind of created these different things that, these different, I guess, beasts that that can, you know, really excel with what wolves can do. Which,
yeah,
I find very cool, because a lot of people think, oh, the wolf was the strongest, the biggest. It's like, no, not really.
Yeah, yeah.
They're actually, you know, golden retrievers that are bigger than wolves. So it's really neat to see how that can be done.
So, like, can a wolf be domesticated?
You know, I'm sure, like, a dog trainer, that would be their dream challenge. And we do have socialized wolves at the Wolf Conservation Center,
mm-hmm.
so they're not fearful of people, but by no means would I consider them domesticated. And I kind of like it that way.
Yeah.
So I kind of like to think that they cannot be, especially since I would hate to encourage people to try to do it and have a wolf, you know, in their apartment or house. But you know, I don't know. Amazing things have been done, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure all animals have their own personalities in the same way. However, we ended up creating dogs from wolves, there must have been a couple of wolves that were a little bit more tolerant of people. And so I guess if you run into the right wolf, you never know. But
that's true.
I'd like to think that you can't. And I definitely would encourage no one to try.
Yeah, I'm with you. It's just, I'm so with you. I mean, it's like, you know, one of the theories is that, you know, 30,000 years ago, there were a bunch of guys hanging out by a fire and it was really cold. And when they fell asleep, the wolf came and slept with them and became their dog. And, you know, and it's like, it's not that simple. You know, it's like.
Yeah. And I think people were a lot different back then, too.
Yeah, to say the least. You know? Like, oh, look, it's a dog. No, not really. So I kind of hate to ask this question, but I want to know, how smart are wolves?
I think, well, they definitely have street smarts, and they are smart. You know, a lot of their smarts isn't definitely going to be measured the same way we measure the intelligence of a dog, let's
say.
Yeah. You know, and a lot of people, you know, there's a very interesting institute, I think, in Austria right now that does a lot of work with dog cognition and wolf cognition, and have found some pretty interesting things. But really, you know, wolves are very smart, and one of the ways that I think the best trait about wolves is just their communication skills.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really depends on how you measure intelligence. But, you know, wolves, they communicate with one another on so many levels, and that's because they have to work as a team, and or they benefit from working as a team. So, you know, just the way they can, it was actually a paper about it earlier this year, the way they can use their eyes, their eye expression or eye direction, can actually help kind of coordinate other members of the team and let them know what to do. So it's just really interesting to me how their smarts can be used for survival.
Yeah.
So dogs, a lot of the time, I think we measure their intelligence with how they respond towards people.
Yeah.
So, and that's something that that wolves are just not really designed to care about mm-hmm. people. But it was interesting. We had a great program. Her name is Julie Hecht, and she's a biologist or a scientist that works a lot with dog cognition, and she came and did this whole thing and talked about how dogs, they respond, even the way they look at your faces, and they know how what a point is, you know, they know to follow the end of the finger to
yeah.
whatever you're pointing at, and
yeah.
and how to solve problems. And she did all these demo, you know, all these great video and showed all these demonstrations. And then she wanted to do a demo. And so I brought my dog, a different dog, not my dachshund, a border collie mutt, who's supposedly supposed to be, you know, Mr. Smarty Pants,
yeah.
being a border collie. And he failed miserably during the demonstration. Miserable.
Oh, no.
And he is a Smarty Pants. But then we went up to visit one of our socialized wolves. His name is Atka, and who's supposedly not going to follow the point or do anything, and he did everything perfectly. So he failed miserably, too.
Oh, no.
Who knows? I think we just got two lemons when it came to her messaging. But you know, I think really the difference is with you know, wolves and dogs and anything really. They're built to survive in the wild.
Yeah.
And so that's where their smarts can come in handy. But they do learn and they can communicate things that they learn to other members of the family. There have been cases and studies of wolves being studied in Alaska that actually had their own hunting methods, their own kind of almost like their like, you know, like if you're playing football, like their own play.
Wow.
You know, we're going to run this play on this. And they would teach these traditions within the family. So generations down the line, this one pack would have these unique kind of hunting traditions that were not being displayed among any other packs.
Cool.
So it's really interesting just in terms of communication and their family network, how special and kind of similar wolves are to people.
Yeah, that's what I'm, as you've been talking, I'm like, wolves are more like people than they are like dogs by a lot.
Yeah.
You know?
It's true.
So I want to ask you one more question, and then we're going to talk about your organization. But I wanted to know, I've been hearing a bit about the reintroduction of wolves in Yellowstone, and I was wondering what your thoughts are on that and how you think it's going.
Well, wolves, you know, it was kind of an amazing moment where the political stars were aligned that this caper almost of reintroducing, you know, this large predator into Yellowstone in northern Idaho, central Idaho was able to happen, but it mm-hmm. did. And it was in 1995 and 1996 that wolves were actually reintroduced into Montana or into Yellowstone National Park, also central Idaho. And of course, whenever anything involves wolves, it's going to be surrounded by controversy.
Yeah.
But they did, and actually, what scientists and really everybody was able to learn is that the wolves not only, you know, we learned about their behavior, just kind of their ecological effects on the landscape as a keystone species, as a top predator. But we also learned that wolves have a draw, and people just flocked, especially to Yellowstone, to view these animals in the wild.
Wow.
And there are studies that showed that that annually, the greater Yellowstone region, so the communities are in Wyoming and Montana and Idaho around the Yellowstone Park, that they're going to be getting about $35 million annually from people who come specifically to see wolves.
Holy cow.
So it's really interesting that we learn just so much about them. I think, and even behavior-wise, I think it was a great outdoor laboratory to kind of learn a little bit more about the social dynamics within the pack and between the packs and with the prey, and of course the ecological effects. But I think the economic effect was a little bit of a surprise.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate in terms of how it's going. It's disappointing at this point because it was in 2011 that federal protections afforded by the Endangered Species Act were removed from wolves from Idaho and Montana.
You're kidding.
And it was done in a way that was unprecedented. It was done by an intervention of Congress. It was a rider on a budget bill.
Wow.
So it did not go through the normal process of delisting a species from the endangered species list.
Mm.
And they had hunts in those two states. That same year, they lost protection.
Mm.
So they went from being endangered to you can buy a wolf tag and kill a wolf. The following year, Wyoming was protections were removed from Wyoming. And the only reason that Wyoming was not included in the 2011 measure is because their management plan was deemed so poor by U.S. Fish and Wildlife that they did not think they'd be able to sustain a population.
Wow.
And but they did delist in Wyoming, and then really in all states bordering Yellowstone National Park, started in 2012, they're allowing hunting. And, in fact, Wyoming's been back in the news because there were a number of large advocacy wildlife groups that filed a suit saying that, you know, Wyoming's management plan is not, they cannot sustain a population there.
Wow.
And so a judge just last month actually reinstated federal protections for wolves in Wyoming only.
Wow.
So it's good news for Wyoming.
Yeah.
Or Wyoming wolves,
yeah.
And also actually good news for wolves in other states as well. You know, right now U.S. Fish and Wildlife is poised to remove Endangered Species Act protections from all gray wolves nationwide. So everywhere in the lower 48 states, with the exception of the critically endangered Mexican gray wolf. And in many states, wolves have already met lost protections. That would be in Michigan and Wisconsin, Minnesota, also Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, parts of Washington, parts of Utah. And but in other areas where wolves are just beginning to recover, or in other areas where they have yet to have that chance to recover, areas like the Southern Rockies, Colorado, areas like the Pacific Northwest, where just had that one wolf that entered California for the very first time in 80 years, a couple years ago.
Wow.
Also here in the Northeast, if we have states like Wyoming, with really aggressive management plans. They have a shoot-on-site plan any time of the year for any reason, for any purpose, in 85% of the state. It's just setting a precedent for these other states saying that that is acceptable.
Yeah.
And it really isn't.
I'm just amazed. I mean, if they're bringing in that much revenue, you would think that that whole surrounding area would be like, you know, wolf swag, you know, like this is the wolf bar and here's the wolf inn and here's the wolf tours and here's the wolf t-shirt, get the hat, spend $2.95. I'm amazed that, you know, with that amount of revenue coming into that part of the country, which, you know, could use some help, that it was just deemed a bad idea. And so, I mean, I'm assuming that part of it is just because of, you know, ignorant mentality on the wolf and, you know, all the legends of wolves that they're bloodthirsty and terrifying and it'll eat your child and, you know, that's all they do. And it's I'm gobsmacked as you're telling me this. I can't even believe that these safety precautions would be removed.
Yeah, and actually in Montana last year it was pretty disgusting. It cost $19 to buy a wolf tag.
Oh,
so that's basically a permit to kill a wolf during the hunting season. And in Yellowstone National Park, they say there's about 100 wolves in the park right now. So if you think $35 million divided by 100,
yeah,
would make each of those wolves, they don't want to put a monetary value on them, but for this demonstration, let's say that's $350,000 per wolf. And yet in Montana, you could spend $19 and then you can kill one of them. So there's actually a biologist that used the expression that they're killing the golden goose.
Seriously.
And they are. And sadly, I think a lot of it is because these animals were reintroduced by the federal government.
Yeah.
So, unfortunately, wolves that were reintroduced by the federal government can have the smell, I guess, of the federal government for those who are opposed to the government.
Wow. I mean, you've got me speechless, girl. This doesn't happen very often. I'm just kind of like, holy cow, like, really, you know?
Yeah.
But I hear you. And I mean, I admire what you do because, I mean, I'm just hearing this for the first time. You're dealing with this every day. I can't even imagine what this would be like to hear about this constantly.
Yeah, it's you know, I think one of the biggest challenges of working for an animal like the wolf is keeping encouraged and keeping the people that you're mobilizing to support wolves encouraged as well.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, it's a challenge, but you can do it, because if you don't stay, if you don't, you know, who's going to help the wolf if we're not going to?
I hear you.
So you just have to kind of, you know, just keep at it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I got to tell you, it's like I had Amanda Lawler on about bats recently, and she's got a big bat sanctuary. And it's very interesting because you guys have very similar situations, you know, and like bats also, I mean, you know, for PR purposes, bats are not like the top of the list of like, oh, it's so cute, let's save it, you know, and wolves are kind of like, oh, my God, Peter and the Wolf, all those, you know, childhood fairy tales like, oh, mean and nasty. So, I mean, a big reason of why I wanted both of you guys on was to educate the public about the fact that these are not just killing machines and that they do have purposes. And so, yeah, I really appreciate all the information that you're giving, because it's, you know, we got a really, really sensitive ecosystem right now, and the more help we can get, the better. And if animals are going to do this for us, we need to have a little more respect for them and let them do their jobs.
Yes, definitely.
All right, now I want to talk about the Wolf Conservation Center, because I think it's the coolest place in the world. I'm dying to do some of your events. I can't even tell you. So I'm going to start with the events because they're so freaking cool. Will you please tell us about sleeping with the wolves?
Sure.
I'm like...
well, that's a relatively new thing we're doing. I guess it's about 2 years old. And we actually, we allow people, we camp out at the Wolf Conservation Center. So we can accommodate between 8 and 10 tents, and we have tents, and we rent them out to people. They're 4-people tents. And really, it's a pretty laid back program, because you're there for, you know, 12 hours or something. But we'll eat our dinner up by the wolves. We discuss the wolves. We actually show movies. We have an outdoor little movie set up that we do it right next to the wolves. And in fact, we have one wolf, one of our ambassador education wolves. He's only 6 months old. And at the last time we did a movie there, it was so cute, because he was actually sitting. We put the movie theater or movie screen right outside their enclosure.
Mm-hmm.
And he was actually just sitting there watching with us.
Oh.
And he was probably like, woo. And it was actually the movie about She-Wolf. It was about 06. So I think he was blown away by this female wolf. But the best part, you know, we have, you know, campfire and the whole thing. But I think one of the best parts is just, you know, being rattled in the middle of the night because you hear 20 wolves howling.
Yeah.
And it's wild. It's really neat. And, you know, when we first decided to do it, we didn't know, like, oh, well, do you think anyone would want to do it? I don't know. And we just kind of put it out there. And it has been extremely popular.
Cool.
Like, it's been overwhelming, which is great. We're not complaining. But it's great. It's a lot of fun.
Well, I'm trying to scrape up a bunch of friends to do it in spring. Like, we're all... It's so funny, too, because people are like, wait, like, the wolves are right outside of your tent? And I was like, I really don't think that we're going to be in the wolf enclosure, you know, with, like, hot dogs and cheeseburgers.
Yeah, we're not in the enclosure, but you're pretty close, so it's cool.
And so what else do you guys do at the Wolf Conservation Center?
But we do all, in terms of education, we have all sorts of different programs. We're not a zoo or like a nature center that you can just walk through.
Mm-hmm.
In order to visit us, you have to register to attend one of our programs. And it really works out nicely, because that way you're really going to have a better understanding of what you're looking at and the importance of these animals after you learn about them. And it's also great because the wolves are so much more interested than if we just had people kind of filing through all the time.
Yeah, definitely.
It's definitely more of an engaging experience. And we have, you know, we have after school, we have, you know, wolf camp for kids during the summer, we have evening programs as well. I guess we're going to lose daylight soon.
Yeah.
When daylight savings comes back, we'll have evening programs. But it's really great. We also do some off-site programming with one wolf that travels. But really, education is key. It's really the foundation to force any sort of change about the way people think about the wolves, and also the policies around wolves.
Yeah.
We need to educate not only the kids, but the decision makers.
Yeah, big time.
We also do special events. We have, for example, we have a really cool event coming up in beginning of November about the monarch butterfly.
Oh, cool.
Which is going to be really neat. I'm looking forward to that. And no matter what, if it's an event at our facility, you're going to see the wolves, yeah. even if it's a butterfly event. But so definitely that's kind of a perk that the wolves are always there. But I think the event I'm most excited about is coming up in 9 days. Wow.
Ooh.
I can't believe it's already October 20th. And it's in New York City. It's in Soho at the Patagonia store in Soho.
Oh, my God, I'm going to go.
Yeah, it's called Carnivore Comebacks. And really, it's a program where we're just one of the organizations that are part of this program. But it's the Northeast Wolf Coalition's program, all about really the role the wolf has in the landscape, demonstrating different areas where wolves have returned and the impacts they've made.
Cool.
But also, what could happen here if the wolf returned?
Yeah.
You know, if wolves were allowed to recover here in the Northeast, what sort of ecological impact would there be? What sort of economic impact could we see at a Yellowstone sort
yeah.
of situation?
Yeah.
So we really kind of want to introduce the Northeast to New Yorkers, and I'm a New Yorker, but so you think, wow, it's not just buildings and subways, but we actually have a really diverse and amazing landscape here in the Northeast that used to accommodate large carnivores,
yeah.
animals like cougars and animals like wolves and animals like elk. And, well, they're not carnivores, but, you know, and what would happen if we had those? And,
yeah.
and would people be interested in having those? And how would we feel about it? So I'm really looking forward to it. And that's at 7 o'clock on the 29th at Patagonia Soho.
Well,
it's
I'm
really cool.
All over it. If I'm not working, I will be there because this sounds fascinating. I love it. It's so cool. All right, so we got 3 minutes left. So what can us normal human beings do to help wolves?
Well, the first thing, one of the things that we, a phrase that we like to use at the Wolf Center is to rewild your heart. And really that's for people to realize that there's places for wolves and other large carnivores on our landscape, but they have to be allowed in our hearts first.
Nice.
So to really learn as much as you can and embrace these guys for what they are. And they're a natural part of our wild heritage. So there's so many things going on when it comes to wolves and politics right now. So there's all sorts of letters and petitions that you could definitely sign on to probably any day of the week.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely education is key, being open to the idea of wolves, and just doing your research. One thing, you know, we don't have wolves here in New York right now,
mm-hmm.
But for, you know, just being able to know how your representatives feel about wildlife,
yeah.
how they feel about the environmental issues, how they feel about legislation like the Endangered Species Act.
Yeah.
Without the Endangered Species Act, wolves would never have gotten a second chance to come back to our country.
Wow.
So these are all really important things, and it's kind of hard, especially when you're in the city, to be thinking about Endangered Species Act. But really, we need to encourage people to think beyond just their local community when it comes to wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
Because in other communities where we do have animals like wolves, and maybe they're not even supportive of wolves, they are going to be thinking about the Endangered Species Act.
Yeah.
And so we have to remember that all wildlife here in our country, you know, it's a public trust that belongs to everybody in the country.
Mm-hmm.
So we all have an equal voice, and we should use it to safeguard wolves and wildlife, you know, throughout the 50 states.
I love that. I think that's the perfect answer. Thank you. So, sadly, Maggie, we are out of time. I'm bummed out. I could talk to you forever. I'm fascinated. I'm totally going to try to get to see you at the Patagonia store, though. That's 7 p.m. on the 29th, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, 7 p.m. on the 29th, Patagonia Soho. Come on down. Let's learn more about wolves together. And then, Maggie, can you give me some website info and contact info in case anyone wants to find out more about WCC?
Sure. Our website is www.nyasinnewyorkwolf.org. And we're on Facebook. You can visit us there, Twitter. And we have some really cool webcams going on our website, too. So you can check out a lot of our wolves just kind of enter their private lives without them knowing. So I recommend that.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being on, Maggie. I really, really appreciate it. I hope to meet you in person in a couple days. And I'm Celia Kutcher. Thanks for listening to Animal Instinct. We'll be back next week. Take care.
for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.